WOWDLP. Tacoma Park is 9 o'clock. Time to experience some art.
Good morning. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you when you visit the exhibit, create in your soul, in your experience, your own work of art. The Artist Experience radio program has a unique mission. We look into the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not a crane. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up a knock, speak, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down, high wire and a fire. Representing 7 games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. Team by team reporters babble Trump. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive centerate. Light a candle, light a motive, step down, watch a heel, crush, crush, uh-oh. This means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world.
Radio partner and friend Tom, I would like to tell you that we have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. And it's also a place where we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening. It's great. You can stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, and on artistexperience.com, so that you can listen at any time. And the podcast can be found on iTunes and other places also.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you've had a lovely Thanksgiving with friends and family, hopefully, and you're having safe travels and you've been comfortable this holiday weekend. WOWDLP Tacoma Park thanks you again for your support of this great community radio station. Your contributions and donations helped us reach our goal in our fall fundraising drive, and for this, we are thankful. Today, Sheila and I have a bit of a heavy topic to take you through in this holiday weekend. In conjunction with our visit to the National Museum for Women in the Arts in D.C., our visit is really important, and it's kind of long overdue. We have seen exhibitions there, but it's the first time you'd like to share an exhibition by a groundbreaking artist who made her fame in the feminist wave of artists in the 1970s and 1980s. The exhibition is titled Judy Chicago, The End, A Meditation on Death and Extinction, and it goes until January 20th, 2020. A word about the National Museum for the Women in the Arts. The museum is located in the heart of D.C. on New York Avenue. It's between 12th and 13th Street Northwest, and it's the only museum in the world dedicated to the achievements of women artists. It's open daily. It's metro accessible at McPherson Square and Metro Center on the Red Line. Parking is a bit tough, even on the weekends, but it's doable with a bit of patience. There is a fee for the museum. Sheila, can you introduce our listeners to the inception ideas in forming this museum and how you feel as a woman about this museum to showcase women artists? In the gift shop, and it's a very lovely gift shop at the museum, they were selling T-shirts, and one of the T-shirts read, "Can you name five women artists?" And of course, I assume they mean really famous women artists. Well, this is a cultural phenomenon dilemma, as men have dominated the art world. We have talked about this topic, about the lack of women representation in the visual arts, and I believe the trend is changing, albeit slowly, as women have been making great art for millennia, and thank goodness for that.
Well, I'm going to talk about the beginning of this museum. Wilhelmina and Wallace Holiday, they decided to start an art collection, and they were advised that an art collection needs a focus. So they chose to collect art by women because women's art was easily available. Their initial acquisitions, which you can see in the museum's permanent collection, were romantic, dreamy women, you know, sun-dappled, or somber women drawing water from a well, more like very tasteful calendar art. And Wilhelmina Holiday went on a fundraising tour and gave speeches, one of which I went to because, hey, it's a woman's museum. She told us that the museum would be, quote, a forum for greater awareness of women in the arts and their contributions to the aesthetic aspect of life. She said, our intent is not to separate art into male and female, but to uncover and celebrate the hidden contribution of women in the history of art. This was around 1980, and while young women thought this was a feminist idea, Mrs. Holiday certainly did not. So at that time, Judy Chicago, who this show is going to be about, had just finished her monumental work, The Dinner Party. It was widely regarded as the first epic feminist artwork. It's a symbolic history of women in civilization. It's a triangular table, 48 feet on each side, and there are 39 elaborate place settings arranged along the table for 39 mythical and historical famous women, the women who should have been invited to the table. And it was assumed that the museum would be its permanent home, but that was not Mrs. Holiday's idea at all. So they rejected the dinner party, and it was, after a while, boxed up in storage for many years. So finally, it found its home at the Brooklyn Museum.
Well, you know, there's something about that building over there between 12th and 13th and New York Avenue. It's a very impressive structure. And curiously enough, I, you know, did my research, and it was formerly a Masonic temple in the Renaissance Revival style. The main floor as you walk in and the entrance are very tasteful. They're really beautiful. And it certainly doesn't strike one as a museum. I thought it was maybe a bank or something like that.
But after extensive renovation and the museum purchase in 1983, it evolved into the museum it is now. Although the edifice is impressive, the overall feel of the place is not of a traditional museum. And maybe I feel this way because the style and the period of the building seems to be like counter to the vision of a museum highlighting the lives of women artists. I mean, I guess it's going to sound really weird, but, you know, when I think of banks and I think of, like, places like this, I think of a, you know, male-dominated space. I mean, I mean, I hate to say it that way. But the other thing about it, you know, it was a Masonic temple. And Sheila, I don't know if I'm getting myself in trouble here, but I'm not sure the Masons and the men of the Masonic, you know, kind of culture were really truly enthusiastic about women in the art. And, you know what I mean? It goes counter to that. And so the elegance of the place, and it really is nice, it fits an elegance, but not the past karma of it. So I'm thankful that they got rid of the Masons and put the women artists in them. I think they've made it a lot more beautiful in that sense.
It is. It's a beautiful building, but it's really true. It's like no other building. What it is, it has lots of polished marble, beautiful sort of golden colored marble and swooping staircases, and you can take the elevator to the top two floors, which are well at galleries, and they often have really interesting shows. But I want to say that what it really is a beautiful place for receptions, and the museum is used for that a lot. So the museum, maybe it's trying to make it up to Judy Chicago because they didn't accept the dinner party. I've seen some good shows there, and this is not one of them. So here goes me and Tom, because we decided this is our Thanksgiving break, and we're going to tell it like we see it. So Judy Cohen, who became Judy Chicago, had wanted to be an artist, but not just an artist, a famous artist, before she really was an artist, and discovered her feminism when she realized that the art world was driven by men, and she wasn't part of it. She's right. But it didn't occur to her that she wasn't the great artist she thought she was. So she developed what she called a language of feminist imagery. That's a very high goal. And her work at that time was colorful, geometric, repetitive patterns that are pretty handsome. And they evoke women's genitalia or flowers or both. And Chicago, it seems, has always felt that the most effective way to smash patriarchy is for a woman to embody her sexuality and project it back into the world. As I was thinking about this, I asked my neighbor's daughter, who's about 26, and she's a firefighter in the Northwest. And I said, did you ever hear of Judy Chicago? And she looked at me, no. So fame is fleeting. Judy Chicago's large silkscreen paintings, why disguise them? If you haven't seen them, go to our Facebook page, and you may, it will trigger your memory, because they have been everywhere for a long time. Anyway, those images are really famous, but for me, they don't really resonate with any language, visual or internal or psychological, for me. And as designs, they're arresting. Her series, which she called Through the Flower, wouldn't have been possible without a couple of master printers at their workshop, where they knocked themselves out to make her prints. She didn't even get up to sharpen her own pencils. And I read her autobiography. Oh my gosh, is it okay for a narcissist to get many other people to assist you in making your dream of art and not give them recognition? That's what she did, but she did get the work done. I don't really have an answer for this, because she seemed to build these large projects on the backs of admiring women who were looking for a place to belong. And she could have been kinder and more generous. So now Judy is 80, and she feels chosen to enlighten us about her inner observations of death, decay, and extinction.
Well, I thank you for that. Thank you for that introduction, Sheila. I'm shocked and appalled. But anyway, the works are in the exhibition are, and maybe, as Sheila says, this is a kind of payback for Judy Chicago. They're primarily done in black and white porcelain plaques in a small scale with China paint and pen marker. The works are framed in simple and black frames. China paint that used is a glazed porcelain surface was developed in China in the 7th century. Mm. The China painted in these works are kind of very, very neon to funky in color, and they give emphasis to the works, even if it is a limited palette, which is good in this case. The most successful works in the exhibition are actually large funerary casts. They are very well done, and they must have been done by a host of hands, as Schiller has expressed, that she always had a lot of help doing her work. And they are excellent sculptures. And we'll compare the drawings later in the program. The intimacy of these works is curious. You need to go up very close and be confronted by our artist's expressive need to depict her thoughts on death and dying. They're kind of in your face. They're small scale. And these porcelain efforts are many, and they're throughout the exhibition.
Well, Judy said that when she saw the Migration series, which I think probably most of you are familiar with, there's a whole section of Migration series in the Phillips collection.
By Jacob Lawrence.
Right, Jacob Lawrence. And she felt the intimacy of the scale because they are small and that it would suit her new series. I can't really see a connection because for their size, because the Migration series, except for their size, because the Migration series have the power of abstraction that hers don't have. And by this I mean that in the Jacob Lawrence Migration series, abstract shapes and somber colors communicate from far away and close up, and they have a resonance that echoes along with and amplifies the narrative. In Chicago's work, the plaques are laid out in simple lines along the gallery walls, and they have no sense of abstraction. Maybe they're meant to be like shiny black gravestones because there's not much color. So my first encounter is, oh dear, how many rooms of this are there? Not too many, thank goodness. To me, the best piece is not the plaques, but a life cast of Judy herself in death. She's lying on a pillow, holding lilies in her beautifully cast hands. That must have taken courage because it is her, and she does look serene.
Well, we've got to get a little about her bar, but we're going to race through this, Sheila, because there's so much to talk about mm-hmm. those plaques. Well, Judy Chicago, I mean, we have to admit, she was the rage. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I really mean mm-hmm. was the rage in the mid-70s and 1980s. And, you know, she was one of those group of women artists that were waving the feminist flag in the wake of post-pop male-dominated and purely sexist male-dominated art culture, especially in the visual arts. But this wave of feminism came in other parallels in other art genres, like in music. I mean, we had Yoko Ono, you know, Joan Baez. I mean, in the pop world, Heart was a very kind of feminist, Melissa Etheridge. And then we had poetry with Carolyn Forché, Judy Grand, Maya Angelou is a huge, you know, feminist poet. And then, of course, we had the artists like Judy Chicago, Hannah Wilke, Cindy Sherman in photography, mm-hmm. Lynn Hirschman Neeson, and Miriam Chicago. So it was a wave. It was definitely a wave. And mm-hmm. I remember it gave a lot of, you know, courage and inspiration to a lot of women artists. And I remember being at dinner parties and just, you know, her name came up at all every time talking about The Dinner Party, mm-hmm. which was from 1974 to 1979. And they were absolutely, my female artist friends were really inspired. And I actually remembered liking that sense of command that they were getting and courage. And anyway, but, you know, She's had an illustrious career. She was born in Chicago. Judith Cohen, as Sheila mentioned, and she came from a very progressive and liberal parents. Who her father was a member of the Communist Party, and it really shaped her stance. Remember, the communist idea was a little more equality for the women and the women workers. Mm-hmm. So she became active in UCLA. She got married, and unfortunately, her husband Jerry Gerowitz died in a car crash in 1963. And I think that's when things started to change because she wanted to kind of dissolve his name as part of hers, because, I mean, he was gone and she was gonna piggyback his name. She didn't like that. So it went on and on. So she really took on some interesting programs. She was in the forefront, we have to say, you know, an organizer, if you will, of the women.
Yes.
And so she took off in you know, California from the 70s. And
she went to teach at Fresno State College in California because she wanted to escape from male-dominated art world of L.A., and she devised a feminist art program and later went to teach at California Institute of the Arts, trailing a parade of dedicated feminists behind her, which was a self-selected group because how many working-class women could afford to work for her for free? And she developed artist spaces for women to work and to show their work. But the narcissist that she is, she had to surround herself with admiring people, women, to make her point. Although she was married three times to men, and they all helped her along the way. So in 1971, she and Miriam Shapiro became a large collaborative, they developed a large collaborative project called Woman House. This innovative idea was a place for women to talk about their problems and their upbringing. In the society at that time, it was unlike women to really express their real feelings about themselves and their lives. And, you know, that's when women's groups started. And then there was the dinner party, which was a creative lesson for women to teach about their own history. It involved 400 volunteers, many of whom specialized in forms of what used to be called domestic labor. That was rarely acknowledged by the contemporary art world, such as china painting and needlework. And so it was constructed as a traveling exhibition. The work was funded by Through the Flower, a nonprofit that Judy Chicago set up. And a book was made to accompany the exhibition, and it was titled The Dinner Party and the Power of Popular Feminism. The Dinner Party had mixed reviews with critics. Full disclosure here, my best friend Bev is a ceramicist, and she's known Judy Chicago for years, and so I call Bev. And she said that the craft of the dinner party is awful. And so when you get up close, she said, it's terrible. And of course, how can there be quality control with 400 women working with for no pay on a project? Huh. So Judy Chicago went on to do other projects, such as the Birth Project, the Holocaust Project, and other things. She has more recently explored the feminism and sexuality of Judaism. And she's had a host of artists in residencies and lives in New Mexico with her now husband, photographer Donald Woodman. Her legacy as an educator, feminist organizer, and artist have spanned 50 years. So we went to the National Museum of Women in the Arts to see her latest work about end-of-life issues such as death, mortality, and extinction. So here we are.
Yes, well, if you've just joined us, this is the Artist Experience Radio Show here at WOWDLP Tacoma Park, and we're discussing Judy Chicago's exhibition here at the National Museum for the Arts, The End, A Meditation on Death and Extinction. Sheila, I've been kind of pretty much obsessed by death for a host of reasons with me and my work, and it's been a topic that's been with me for many years, and I've had a series of near-death experiences, so this topic is very relevant to me, and it had a profound meaning on my own life. So I was kind of excited to see the show, and it's not an issue with me expressing oneself about death. I mean, I don't find it difficult, but my spiritual and religious life has been important to me, and that has helped me shape my ideas about death and dying and extinction. So this is a very personal topic, and like Judy Chicago, to express oneself in drawing and painting and my death and near-death experience has been kind of natural. But it's not an easy thing to do for all artists, but it's not an original idea, and that's what I wanted to bring up right here.
Uh-huh.
Many artists have reached a personal abyss and possibly a zenith, but, you know, how you see life and your death has been expressed. I mean, Rembrandt, for instance, dealt with that in his issues in the 1600s. And probably one of the most memorable artists is the Spanish artist Francisco Goya, who was dealing with death in the early 1800s. He was blind, poor, and out of, out of the graces of the Spanish royalty. So he was really talking about his end. And of course, we have Caravaggio in the early 1600s, and you know Mark Rothko in his late period with those gray paintings.
Right, where the light was just going out.
There was no light in those Rothkos in the late 1960s, and of course, he took his own life. And then Andy Warhol in the 80s, who had a profound death experience. And of course, we have Keith Haring in dealing with the AIDS epidemic, which he was a part of and became a victim of. Mm-hmm. Everyone handles this heavy-duty topic really differently, and artists confront it from a host of emotional, psychological, and spiritual points of view, as Judy Chicago did in the exhibition we're talking about. But then I realized all the artists I named were male artists.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, what about female artists? Have they dealt with the death topic? And I immediately thought of Kata Kovitz, mm-hmm. The German artist who dealt with, she never had any children, but she did tremendous amounts of portraits of children starving. She lived between through World War I and through World War II in Germany, and she saw a lot of death and destruction, and she dealt with that. Eva Hess and her very short life, and Alice Neal. Remember those paintings of Alice Neal as an older woman?
Yes.
Almost contemplating her end.
Yes.
You know, at the end of the bed, there's a few of those. So I'm throwing it out there. I mean, could you think of any women artists that dealt with death issues before Judy Chicago?
Well, I can. And I hope I'm not going to ramble, but to me, this is a fabulous thing to know about, is that 20 years ago, I went with my mother to the Jewish Museum in Manhattan to see the paintings of a German artist, Charlotte Salomon. And she, in her 26 years on this earth, she spoke very little. She's very quiet, but she poured her observations into 1,700 paintings, which documented the day-to-day life of her upper-class Jewish intellectual crazy family, which was about to blow up under the weight of their secrets. It chronicles the genesis of an artist from a family of dark secrets, mental illness, nervous breakdowns, molestation, suicides, drug overdoses, and love triangles. So like many Jews during the Holocaust, they kept a stash of morphine, opium, and Veronal to use when their money ran out. But Solomon's crime, which she did commit, was not a mercy killing to save an old man from the gas chambers. Solomon actually murdered her grandfather. And this was in 1943 in February, 8 months before Charlotte Solomon was murdered in Auschwitz. She did kill her grandfather. Her grandparents, like many Jews, had fled Germany in the mid-1930s. But this killing was entirely personal. It was Herr Dr. Ludwig Grunewald, not Herr Hitler, who Solomon wrote, symbolized for me the people I had to resist. She documented the event in real time in a 35-page letter, most of which has only recently come to light. She said, I knew where the poison was, and it is acting while I write. Perhaps he's already dead now, forgive me. She also describes how she drew a portrait of her grandfather as he expired in front of her from her Veronal omelet that she cooked for him and fed to him. The ink drawing that she made as she watched him die is a distinguished, wizened man, his head slumped against the collar of his bathrobe, his eyes closed, his mouth a thin slit nesting in his beard, and that survives. So if you go on Facebook, you can see that drawing that she did watching him die. All the women that came after Charlotte's mother, grandmother, there were six in her lineage, and they all committed suicide. She was the last. Her story of murdering her sexual predator grandfather was hidden until about 5 years ago. That's why I really am bringing this up.
Wow, that's so heavy.
Amazing. Mm. So when we talk about death and power and grief, this is powerful.
Well, it certainly sounds it. And thank you for sharing that. Wow. We started the show saying that this was a heavy topic. And once again, if you joined us right at that moment, we need to tell you we're talking about the Judy Chicago exhibition at the National Museum for the Art of Women in the Arts. And it's the exhibition is titled The End, A Meditation on Death and Extinction. Well, the exhibition is separated into three parts. The first part being the end, mortality, and then the end, meditation, and finally the end, extinction. The exhibition is heavy from the start, and not a good heavy. And it starts out with a kind of bad heavy, so we're going to warn you. And it ends on a good note, and the last hurrah of extinction, if you could call extinction a good note. But the work is more successful in that particular gallery space. And, of course, it should be important to all of us on this planet right here, right now, about the extinction of flora and fauna and humanity on the planet right now. But by time you get to that that section, I have to tell you, I was feeling really bad for Judy Chicago and her efforts with this exhibition. I mean, because after, you know, talking about going extinct was confusing me, and I actually was thinking of the word extinguish. You know, it's kind of going to sound really weird, but in other words, I wanted it to end. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted lights out, so to speak, because I think this is an example of really great bad art. And what do I mean about that? Well, Sheila and I are going to gather our senses and share in the second half of the show what great bad art is. And we have some distinct reasons why. And this exhibition falls flat for a host of reasons. I myself, for a host of emotional, psychological, and spiritual premises, find this exhibition troubling. But we're going to take a little break. And I just stated, as part of the exhibition, and the best part of the exhibition is on extinction. So we're going to listen to a masterpiece about that, just that topic, extinction. And it's a really beautiful song, which I have known for years, called To the Last Whale by David Crosby and Graham Nash, formerly of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. It's a beautiful song and about a heavy topic, and it's stated mellifluously in this beautiful song, To the Last Whale. Da, da, da. Thank you.
the years you swam the ocean, following feelings of your own. Now you are washed up on the shoreline. I can see your body lie. It's a shame you have to die. Put the shadow on your eyes. Maybe we'll go. Maybe we'll disappear. It's not that we don't know. It's just that we don't want to care.
Hi, welcome back. I'm going to introduce this idea of bad, great art. This is Tom's idea.
Well, great, bad art.
Great, bad art. So I'm going to talk about bad drawing, okay, and kitsch. I've always loved the critic, Robert Hughes. He's an Australian writer, and he wrote art criticism for Time magazine for many years, and he has a whole book of his art criticism, and he had very strong principles that art criticism should never be about I like it or I hate it or it works or it doesn't work. He believed that his job was to explore, shed light, to understand and communicate his understanding of art, which he stood by, except when he eviscerated Julian Schnabel, the art star of the 1980s. We have very similar principles in this show. We really try to be even-handed. And when he wrote in the 1980s about Julian Schnabel, who was the biggest art star, he was 26 years old, and Hughes wrote, his growth was smothered by his impregnable self-esteem. I thought that was so great. And that's, in a nutshell, why Schnabel has never learned to draw. Yeah. And Hughes, he didn't write that about Judy Chicago, but I could say the same thing, not so eloquently, but Judy Chicago never learned to draw. I don't know why this never came to her attention. But as far as I'm concerned, that's the weakest point about this whole series. I know, Tom, when we were looking at you, you were going, look at that anatomy. What is that elbow? And when we talk about drawing, we're not talking about realistic drawing, but we're talking about a basis in good drawing. And so Hughes wrote about what went wrong in American art schools in the 70s. And he said, until then, without exception, every significant artist of the last 120 years was drilled or drilled themselves in academic drawing. And he says, only in this way was the right to radical distortion within a continuous tradition earned. And it's very much like improvisational jazz. It's like there's always a structure underneath. Even if the structure is not even specific, you feel that structure. And this kind of rigor had been leached out of American art schools by the 1970s.
For sure.
Yeah. So Judy Chicago was raised to feel special. By her own account, because I read her autobiography, she was exceedingly bright. She was exceedingly talented. And she set out to be, well, Judy Chicago. She's basically a graphic designer. And as design goes, the results were pretty beautiful, if you like that kind of thing. But in this new project, she's relying on the figure to express her or an our feelings. And it just doesn't work because the figure is so badly done. No matter how stylized or abstract or expressive she thinks it is, she really can't fake it.
Well, amen, Sheila. I can go on for days about the bad drawing in these works. As Sheila suggested, the anatomical nuances of these figures are constructed very amateurishly and sadly inaccurate. in a way that does not contribute to the experience of death and dying. Yes, as we are dying, our physiognomy, our skeleton and muscular structures change, but not in these ways. These works amount to like bad cartooning, and it's, I don't think it's appropriate for such a heavy topic on death and dying. It's kind of a childish look at death, but in a kind of very bad and kind of immature light. There's a heavy-handedness to the drawing that really kind of seems inappropriate for the intensity and also the scale of the works. And these works are filled with typography and writing. The figures have a bulkiness that are very reminiscent of the Mexican muralists like Diego Rivera and David Sigueras. But for the truth of the matter, these muralists could draw. There's no doubt about it. And these bulkiness and strengths come out of a history of rich Mexican drawing tradition, which, of course, is shared with the Spanish. Another aspect of these works, which were profoundly weak, is the handwritten type, yeah, as I just alluded to. There's a lot of reading you have to do in looking at these, and that's a lot of stuff to take on to evoke a vocabulary in the states of mortality and dying and extinction. And besides, the words are not very readable, legible, and it slows down the impact of the work. I would have rather got done away with all those words. And then you get hooked up on the waves of words. They're kind of written in a wavy fashion. And it's a very tenuous road to hoe when you put words into a painting. Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous. You have to be very careful about that. And it changes the context of the visual. And we're not talking about literature here. We're talking about visuals. It's what we see. So literature and art mixed opens up a whole new can of worms. And the worms seem in a seem appropriate for worms are really appropriate for death and dying. You might as well throw in a few maggots while we're at it, and voila, we have it. But it's not working here in the gallery. And the other thing is, this literary vomit on all these images are really, you know, really to take the people away. And I was watching people in those galleries, and they were running through that show like bats out of hell. And they were skipping out because it became kind of torturous to look at each one of these with so much writing in it. And they paid an entrance fee to boot. That was really other damage. Okay, well, I heard a few people ask loudly, and they were being accompanied by a friend, a significant other, possibly the poor bear at their funeral in a few years. And they kept on asking, are you afraid of death? Well, it's a perfectly appropriate question in the gallery space, so that I felt was good. But I never heard an answer from anyone, and they just kept on shaking their heads. So I was left with this enigma. Yes, they began to think about their own death, which I think is positive, but, you know, I never really got an answer. In other words, nobody was sharing the goods about their own personal feelings.
I actually tried to sidle up to people to listen to them, but I couldn't quite get close enough without sort of just interfering in their space. But I want to say that these are not Judy's thoughts. Each of these plaques have a painted drawing, a figure or two, or sometimes one and a half figures. And there's that handwritten text. But the first group is the text by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she was a Swiss-American psychiatrist, a pioneer in near-death studies, and the author of the groundbreaking book on death and dying, which she first discussed her theory of the five stages of grief. And these five stages are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And this is what are illustrated in these first plaques. If Judy Chicago is bravely modeling for us what it feels like to be 80 and looking at death, why doesn't she tell us that in her own words? I think she feels that her own illustrations have such power that they communicate her experience profoundly. Unfortunately, they don't. So her pieces in the third part of the show also feature words from either Chicago or writers that have inspired her. Certain words and phrases are bolded for maximum effect. And when I read the review of this exhibit, they are so completely in sync with Chicago's intention, but not for me. And her meditation on extinction is not her own words either. This gets back to a question we've asked long ago for this show and me. What if you just don't like it? And what if the artist themselves is just transparently unlikable? Does that and should that matter? This brings up for me probably an unanswerable question, but especially now, with our consciousness consumed by the effects of narcissism, which we're looking at daily, and the Me Too movement, it brings up so much about art. Chicago's stylized figures, do they really connect with other women? And am I just like a bad critic or a prude? I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting that you're coming from the woman's point of view there. That's interesting. Well, the artist, as Sheila just mentioned, quotes Socrates, Kubler-Ross, and Albert Camus, the great writer and existentialist. And that's nice, but like, it's not her words. And I don't know, when I'm dying, I'm certainly not going to be thinking of some famous quote on dying. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to be living that experience. And that's why I thought the words were really not helpful. Could it be yourself and what you love? And some of these are also not only about your own death, but the death of other people close to you that you love. So we all have to experience this in life. This is something we all have to deal with. So I think it's a very important thing, and it's a very important outlet for expression. And the images of denial and isolation, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, I was very perplexed because the figures look masculine, and I'm not sure why that is. I mean, and maybe the answer for that is, does it really matter what your gender is when you're dying? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a philosophical question.
It is.
I mean, at that point, are you thinking about your maleness or femaleness? You know, when you're dying, I don't think so. I think there's a lot of other things to maybe to think about than that. And then they talk about the universal fear of death, which Kubler-Ross talks about, and that should be taking over. Now, some of us might fear death, some of us not. I don't know if there is a universal fear of death. I hear that's not always true. So in the end, it's really about survival. I think the human animal wants to survive, just like the animals in the wild. That's a very natural inclination, right, to want to survive. We must think about our own inevitable end. And this is a part of the quote, one of the quotes from Socrates, and he said, depending on how we look at it, we may hold to the hope that death is a sort of bonus. So there's a very interesting concept of how this ancient Greek thought about death. And the Greeks also were very big on cynicism, so maybe you could take that in a cynical light. But my knowledge of philosophy is pretty weak, so I'm gonna leave that one alone. But he's mentioning that it's a bonus, and maybe there's a sweet prospect about that. And I don't really get any of that in these works.
Nothing of that. Also, somewhere in the exhibition, they did talk about the difficulty of working with this particular medium, this painting on this black glass. And, you know, that really is a weak statement, because an artist decides what medium they want. And the difficulty of working in that medium is on them. It's not on us. So I wanted to say that these ideas, Tom, what you're talking about, these are profound ideas. And they've been in our current discourse. But the person who has chosen herself as the purveyor of these ideas is not adequate to the tasks. So I wonder if anyone has tried to tell her, to prod her into going deeper. This is the deepest part, to get her to communicate on a deeper level, and probably not. And that's my real question, that maybe these ideas are just not suited to imagery. And, you know, like, what's the deal with the black glass plates? The best images are like good book illustrations, the ones on extinction, and they have, you know, animals sort of surrounded by ice floes and, you know, marooned on the rocks. And I want to go, give me a break. We all know about this. Photography for this is a much better medium.
very good.
To convey this stuff.
But something a little of a diversion, which I think is really, really important in viewing this exhibition, is that, and it struck me like right now, here and now, in this country, in this Washington, D.C. area, we could put a positive take about this exhibition. And here's what I was thinking as I was going through it. I was looking for something positive to get out of this exhibition. And we've had a week of testimony on Capitol Hill in these impeachment inquiries where America and the world were witnessing two very strong feminine testimonies by remarkable women in Marie Yovanovitch and Fiona Hill. These are women that went up before the world and talked about their experience. Well, there's a fortitude, a resolve, an eloquence of these women. And it reminded me that this is kind of what we really need here. And I think that exhibit lacked that, a sense of fortitude and resolve and eloquence. Mm-hmm. It was very schmaltzy. And these were bright, articulate, and convincingly honest women to lead this country in what we are going through right now. And that sent something to the power of a woman's statement. That's my point in all this.
Yes.
And looking at the works of Judy Chicago, you know, her metaphor for death and dying might be, and here's where I'm thinking, is she talking maybe kind of metaphorically about our nation, our democracy, our human values, or the global condition that we're in right now with climate change? I was gasping and grasping at some kind of hope that she was trying to convey, and I'm not sure she was trying to convey that. But the parallel narrative that I was seeing a mile away from this museum right now at the Capitol and in the White House, it's curious how it hit me in looking at these works. I was looking for something with a lot more strength, like these women that went and before the nation to talk about, you know, a kind of truth to their experience. So, and then I think that's what art could do. In some ways, they were being literary about it in Ms. Yovanovitch and Dr. Fiona Hill, but it also kind of collected my thoughts that what we're really looking at was great bad art instead.
Wow. Good for you. Because my feeling is if Judy Chicago wanted to show the power of women as artists, she needed to be a better artist. So in the 1970s, the women's movement needed art to express their vision. And Judy Chicago, I'm going to give her credit for this. She was like bringing to light the denial of Georgia O'Keeffe. And forgive me the comparison, because O'Keeffe is a fantastic painter. But a lot's been said about the sexual imagery in her paintings, which she always denied. And Chicago's art did serve a function if you buy into it. But there are so many new artists who are and have been not so much creating women's art, but creating art as women. And I know women still need to fight for recognition, but Judy Chicago does not speak for me. So Tom and I would like to talk about the last room in this exhibition that deals with the extinction of plants, animals, insects, and species that are critically endangered.
Well, the last extinction room is important. I think it's the best section of the exhibition. And, you know, there's still a lot of kitschiness to the images of the vanishing species. The best drawn image of the entire exhibition, and this is the drawn image, not the sculptures, is the coral reef images.
Yeah, I agree
from,
with you.
From before and after getting bleached at the seabed. That is really the most tasteful and actually well-drawn part of the exhibit. Mm-hmm. I was a biology major, and I had a course intensity in zoology, so I know all about these animals and stuff. But there seems to be, in other words, a kind of a callous depiction of these kind of things. And again, the designs are weak. They're drawn, you know, amateurishly. And I think it kind of takes away from the message. And again, you know, if you've just joined us, we're talking here at the Artist Experience Radio Program at WOWDLP Tacoma Park. We're talking about an exhibition at the National Museum for the Arts in D.C., Judy Chicago, The End, A Meditation on Death and Extinction. Well, we'll the time is running out.
All right.
We're dying and getting extinct here on our hour program. Any closing comments, Sheila?
Sure. Well, this show, as you can tell, has raised a lot of questions, especially for me. What is the place of great male artists in the Me Too movement? How much disclosure is important or necessary? Is it important to say that Modigliani was a heroin addict and his young wife, Jean, a subject of some of his wonderful paintings jumped out of the window? Does Picasso's hatred for women matter? I was at the home of collectors that had a Picasso rape scene right above their dining room table, but it was a Picasso. So is it my place to judge as bad art? The risk, and risk turning off a lot of listeners, and you please disagree with me. Write to us on Facebook if you don't agree, even though it's our program. But how much of art is what it triggers in our own experience? That is in part what our show is about. So in this week's Washington Post, there was a review of a Gauguin exhibit. And because of the Me Too movement, it's brought up a lot of stuff. And the writer talked about whether Gauguin should be rejudged by his life and his content. Gauguin went to Tahiti and he painted the barely teenage girls he had relations with. He impregnated them and he basically became a travel ad for this exotic life, which brought disease to the tropical paradise. So maybe for Gauguin it was paradise, but he brought uncared for children and disease into his paradise. So now, what text do we put on museum walls? I've never seen Gauguin as a great painter, but many do. So what do we do now? It's the same problem as taking the Confederate statues out of our town squares. Or do we relabel the paintings, giving it context of truth to Gauguin?
Yes, interesting. Actually, I'm a fan of Gauguin painting, but so we might agree. We might disagree on that one. Well, Judy Chicago, The End, A Meditation on Death and Extinction, is an exhibition that goes till January at the National Museum for the Women in the Arts. It's a wonderful museum. This topic has been heavy, and it merits lots of visual dialogue and as well as dialogue. We'd like to thank you for your time here, and we wish everyone a safe and end to the Thanksgiving Day weekend, and we hope you've enjoyed this show. Sheila, really quickly, anything going on for the future show?
Oh, boy. Well, you've mentioned a couple of things, and I'm going to leave it for us.
All right, surprise, surprise, surprise.
Okay,
well, there's no surprises coming up next with Bobby Hill and this music. Bobby's going to share his great knowledge of musical depth with this music from 10 to 1, Avant-Garde George Wright, right here. Experience art and the visual in everything you do, and thanks for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes.
And you're tuned to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park.